The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
I think this time you've said enough to make me want to leave this place. Still, I keep coming back for more of the same to fan the dying flame here inside these walls that seem to move a little closer every day. This is Carefree Highway Revisited, the show that celebrates the work of Gordon Lightfoot song by song, a proud member of the FM Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mike Messner, and along with me today is a fellow Lightfoot fan from Buffalo, New York, John Colaga. John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, Michael, it's a pleasure to be here.
How did you first get into Gordon's music?
Well, I grew up in the Niagara Falls, Buffalo, New York area, which, if you know your geography, is right on the Canadian border.
Yeah.
And so we got to listen to a lot of CBC radio. And also, the Buffalo stations play a lot of Canadian music. So Gordon appeared on our playlist, I guess, with If You Could Read My Mind in about 1970. And he's been sort of a mainstay of Western New York radio since that time. I received the album Sundown for a Christmas present in 1974 when I was 15. And that was a real life changer for me. And I've been a fan ever since.
That record is indeed life changing for a whole lot of people, and not the least of whom was Gordon himself, because now he's gotten international acclaim, not just in the States and Canada. What about viewing him in concert? Did you ever get a chance to see him?
Yes, I'm happy to say I did. I saw him after Sundown. I became a big fan and waited for him to come around. And he played at the Niagara Falls Convention Center in 1977, touring for Summertime Dream. I had really great seats for that. I was a senior in high school. And the following year, he played at probably the premier venue for hearing music in Western New York, which is Kleinhans Music Hall, which is where the Buffalo Philharmonic plays. And it was an astounding show. You know, the acoustics were amazing and he was great. And then I saw him a few years later at a smaller venue called Melody Fair in about 1980. And I will say that he was not in a great physical shape at that time for that concert. I missed him a couple of times in the 80s. So I really only saw them the three times, but they were great shows.
And it sounds like those are all reasonably small venues. I've never been to Buffalo, but the way you describe them, I mean, these are not stadiums. These are reasonably intimate settings. Am I right in thinking that?
Well, the first one, the Niagara Falls Convention Center, is probably a little bigger. I would say it's about 10,000 people. And the other two were smaller, more in the 1,000 to 2,000 seat. But big enough, but not so big that they were stadium experiences.
Right. I don't think that Gordon's music lent itself to that. 10,000, I think, is probably the extent of the venue that he would really make a connection, just because that was not his style of music. This was not big time rock and roll like the Rolling Stones. So you today wanted to talk about Now and Then from the Cold on the Shoulder record. And as we're going to find out a little bit later, that one is a very deep track buried way down on the second side of the record. I wanted to talk a little bit about why we found this song interesting, and I'll go first on this one. It has an interesting form to it. Right when you think a stanza is about to end, he rolls into the next thought. There's a lot of fun internal rhyming in it, but it's still very eloquent, and it talks about heartbreak, and it talks about the idea of, I can't see myself leaving this relationship yet, and I'm stalling for time. I'm just trying to find some way to hang on to this a little bit longer, even if you know that it's just not going to be in the cards. So why did you want to talk about that song today?
Well, there's many reasons. I believe that Gordon Lightfoot was a genius at writing songs about emotions that most people are uncomfortable spending time talking about. You know, you have If You Could Read My Mind, which obviously is about marital failure, Sundown about jealousy and anger, and Now and Then, when it comes right down to it, I've been thinking about it. I think the song is really about weakness, about a person's inability to move on from a relationship and being really torn between those aspects of it that are very attractive and those that are much more difficult and harmful and hurtful. And I find it an incredibly unguarded and honest piece of music. We can talk about other aspects of it, but to me, it's really the sign of a great songwriting about a very subtle and important kind of mixture of emotions that many of us have had.
You said the word weakness, and I think that is something we are going to delve into, the idea that he doesn't have the strength to face reality to some degree or another. And there's a biographical aspect to that that we're going to get into in just a second. What to you would be the best setting for you to listen to this song? Or if you want to put it another way, the most cinematic place to listen to this? Or is this a song that you could listen to anytime, day or night, doing anything during any weather at any place?
Well, this song, I think, is less about the outdoors and nature and so forth, that many of the themes that are prevalent in his songs. So I think it's the kind of piece of music that you could listen to anytime, although I think it's quite an introspective type song. So, I mean, I have to say that since Gordon's death last May, I've been listening to a lot of Gordon Lightfoot, more than I have in recent years. But normally I listen to his music in the fall. I really enjoy it. For some reason, there's a resonance there that I subconsciously have made. But this is, to me, it's a song that you could sit and have a cup of coffee or something a little stronger and just really delve into it. I think it's a song that ages very well and is very rich.
It does age, and I think it is, in a lot of ways, it's universal. Ironically, despite that, it was not released as a single, and it didn't show up on any of the compilation albums. And it's only been covered once. We'll talk about that as we go on. I think for me, I would want to listen to this at night, because my sense of it is that the argument that they have just had when he's writing this song has happened at the end of the day when they're both tired and maybe they've had a few things to drink. And so we all make the best decisions in the world, right? When we're exhausted and intoxicated. So he's just about at the point where he's saying, you know, this is it. I'm leaving. I can't stand this anymore. But then he's saying, but I can't face the uncertainty of what would be if I leave this. So I'm thinking night. I'm not thinking about it in a particular season, but I think during the nighttime, after dark, it would be the time that I would listen to this.
That makes sense. As I said, I think it's a very introspective, thoughtful song. I think probably later is better than earlier to sort of check this song out and just sort of let it wash over you.
Yeah, well said. There hasn't been a huge amount written about the origins of this song that I could find out. What I do know is that he wrote it at a time when his first marriage has just ended. And if the divorce papers are not finalized, they're about to be. But for all intents and purposes, his marriage to Britta was over. Kathy Smith is all over this album in terms of influences. And Nicholas Jennings said that the song, and I'm quoting directly, "The song describes how a relationship on its last legs continues to exert its power to attract and repel." I love the way that he phrased that. And that is the sum total, John, of everything I could find about how this song got written. Do you have an angle on this or anything you can add?
No, I do have a copy of a book called Chasing the Dragon, which you probably know about. It's a book that was written by Kathy Smith and about her life in rock and roll and with Lee Von Helm and Gordon Lightfoot and ultimately John Belushi. It does describe in some great detail a pretty rocky relationship that had ups and downs and a lot of hurtful behavior. So it seems to me to resonate with that. And I expect, like you, that this song originates out of his relationship with Kathy Smith. I've always felt that Gordon Lightfoot, with all due respect, is singularly unhelpful when describing what his songs are about and where they come from. In the liner notes from the songbook collection, he says it's about unrequited love. I think that's not correct. He did have a relationship. It's just fallen apart. It's not about unrequited love. It's about love that's on its last legs, as you said. So to me, Gordon is at heart, a kind of a small town guy. He was raised in the church. He's very uncomfortable talking about fraught relationships. And yet in this song, it all comes through. And that's the amazing thing. He probably would never want to describe it out loud, but in the use of his language here, and this is what makes this song so great, it really captures the best parts and the worst parts of a relationship in 4 minutes. I mean, it's really an incredible song.
Yeah, he is a little bit more transparent than Dylan when he talks about where the songs came from, but this is among the most enigmatic. And wouldn't you know, when I went online to look at the songbook liner notes, that website was down. So thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think it's about unrequited love at all. I think it's about love lost. When I hear about unrequited, it's more like a love that never was, as opposed to a love that is dying. So yes. Let's look at the lyrics a little bit. And the lyrics are beautiful in all sorts of ways. I think this time you've said enough to make me want to leave this place. So again, he's angered by what this woman is saying. He's heard it before, but now he thinks some line has been crossed because he's saying, okay, this time you have gone too far. This time I don't want to be reminded of this anymore. I'm out of here. Still, I keep coming back for more of the same. To fan the dying flame here inside these walls that seem to move a little closer every day. And this idea that the flame is dying, the relationship isn't getting anywhere. And he knows that this isn't going to work out, but he's too attached, or as you said, John, too weak to make the break final. He can't quite turn the doorknob and walk out of the room.
Yes. The idea that he's just talked about what an awful time they've just had, and here he is fanning the flame, even trying to rekindle something here, suggests to me a sort of almost like somebody in the throes of an addiction of a certain sort. He knows it's not good for him, but he keeps coming back. It's a complex and quite an admission for him to make in a song that his fans get to hear, that he is kind of caught in the throes of this dilemma, and that's where he is when the song is taking place.
You mentioned the term addiction, and I think it's possible to be addicted to somebody. Lightfoot was at a certain age in his life that he certainly was an adult and had been an adult for some time, but he's just as vulnerable as anyone would be under those circumstances. And we do know that Gordon had an addictive personality. We know about the alcoholism. We know, thank God, that he got sober at some point. But I like the way that you said that, and it ties into other parts of his personality. There must be a way out of this crazy game we play out to the end. Let us just pretend a while. Think about the good things now and then. The fact that he's saying, let's pretend, I'm not quite sure what he's wanting to pretend. Is he wanting to pretend that everything is okay? Or is he wanting to pretend that we're back in the good old days? Because that's what he talks about in the next stanza. But he is asking for some sort of reprieve. He's trying to buy time, even though he knows they can never go back to the time when they were just absolutely puppy love with each other.
Well, yeah, I agree. I was thinking about the pretend word myself. And I think what it, to me, suggests is maybe because he knows the relationship is coming to an end. He's got a little perspective on it. It's almost like he's watching himself in this relationship in a way that you don't have when you're in the throes of love. He's almost observing himself in this relationship, almost like acting, almost like pretending that he's doing that. The other thing that struck me, and I know you're a student of English, the way he says, there must be a way out of this crazy game we play out to the game. He doesn't say, there's got to be a way for me to get out of this, or the way for you to get out of it. It's like somebody else is going to do something here because I can't do it. There's got to be a way out. It's a kind of a passive voice, which I think is interesting and appropriate for a person who just can't seem to turn the doorknob, as you say. He can't seem to get off his chair and move on. So he's hoping for something to happen that'll move him to the next step.
And that's another aspect, John, of addiction, the idea that you expect someone or something is going to come riding in on a white horse and they're going to make everything okay. And if anyone who's ever been in therapy for an addiction or from something where they need a serious change, one of the first things you learn is that no one is coming to rescue you. You have to do the work. You can do that in the company of a trained therapist, but it's not like somebody's going to come in, like your mommy or your daddy is going to come in and say, okay, sweetheart, now everything's going to be all right. And they take you inside after you've stubbed your toe. That's not going to happen here. And it's something that, again, goes back to Gordon's character having addictive tendencies, I guess the best way of saying it. We'll be right back to our conversation with John Kalaga about Now and Then, but first a word from a podcast partner or two.
Radio is so much different than it was in the 80s. We had it all. The music, the movies, the DJs, and morning shows. Back to the 80s Radio is a show from the 80s in podcast form. We bring the memories from that awesome decade back. Join Toscano and Chang every Friday as they take you on a ride back in time, sharing their experiences and laughs. Stop on by and discover some of the wacky things this crazy duo comes up with. They talk about it all, the good, the bad, and the ugly of the greatest decade. Don't miss the greatest 80s podcast in the world. Back to the 80s Radio.
Hi, this is Audie Martello, the host of the Mostly Folk podcast, a 60-minute foray into the music we all love. You will hear newly released albums, classic folk, country, and bluegrass music, as well as some traditional music that may or may not be true to the genre. Sometimes irreverent, often opinionated, but always entertaining. You may even hear a radio magic trick every so often, as well as numerous interviews via Zoom and telephone with established as well as indie artists. Mostly Folk is available wherever you listen to podcasts and always at mostlyfolk.org.
I think this time that was the best time that we two had ever known. We tried the handle of the house upon the shore and found the open door. It's an interesting metaphor, okay, the idea that they didn't own the house, that they just kind of stumbled upon it while they were walking along the beach, or maybe they were headed west towards the shore or something. But they came upon it and it's theirs for the taking. And it might be this idea that Gordon, who by this time, Sundown has come out, he's got this instantaneous fame and notoriety and money and all those kinds of things. And so I don't want to say that he never wanted that, because I think on some level, every musician wants to have that kind of fame and wealth. But I think it was thrust upon him in such a way that he may have felt at some point that, you know, how did this happen? Am I in the ballpark?
Well, I actually think, because it's such an oddly specific use of language, I feel as though this might have actually happened, that he and Kathy Smith or whoever is, they're out in the woods and they're walking around and they're in love with each other. And obviously, this is a cherished memory he's talking about here. This was the best time. And we were out and we were in the woods and we found this house and we went in and maybe they made love. Who knows? But it was obviously very special. It was forbidden, perhaps. It was something they shouldn't have been doing. There's a certain sense. I mean, I'm going to be a little punny here, but they were trespassing. They were trespassing legally by entering a home that didn't belong to them. But also, to use the biblical expression, these are trespasses, you know, in terms of sins, perhaps.
Yeah.
They had a little fling here and it was exciting and she was beautiful and they were together on the shore and was such a special and exciting time. You know, naughty, something that was not allowed or good behavior, I would say.
So it sounds like you're not taking it as a metaphor, that they might actually have found a physical, actual place. And he's talking about experiences. He's not trying to just be alluding to anything.
I obviously don't know, but I feel it's such an interesting and specific reference to this house that I feel like it could have actually happened. They could have been somewhere up in the North Country and were on a lake and they came upon an abandoned home that was closed up and they managed to get inside of it. And it was part of this whole forbidden, exciting romance that they had.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that just in a second or two, about the sinful aspect of it or the rule-breaking aspect of it. Once inside, we found a curious moonbeam doing dances on the floor. This, to me, is just beautiful senselessness. Moonbeams don't dance. They're just present. But moonlight is a romantic thing, and he may have been thinking about some night that either he and Kathy were together or he and Britta were together. And we've heard the allusion of moonlight in other songs that were written earlier in his career. So we're not really clear on exactly what he's referring to. But then it goes to, we were only playing like two children who had stayed away from school. Something you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to cut class. You're not supposed to break the rules. You're not supposed to go outside of the norms. And we know that Gordon did that, not in the literal sense of missing school, but in the sense of he broke the rules, he violated his marriage vows, he did those kinds of things. So when you come back to sin, he doesn't put it in quite as much of a biblical context, but it is a transgression of some kind.
Yes. I mean, I think the moonbeam is, as you say, it's symbolic. I think it references a kind of magical quality that he felt when he was with her. He was playing hooky with her, and it was exciting, it was forbidden, it was naughty, it was fun, and he was riding high in terms of his fame and fortune, and she was a beautiful woman, and it was a great time, although part of him seems to acknowledge with the language here that that wasn't really good behavior on his part, and you get a mixed feelings that he has about it, not being completely proud of his behavior, but still, he was a young man, and opportunities presented themselves, and there was a mutual attraction there.
And it has a lot to do with the kind of life that he was living, which was highly insecure and highly volatile. And we know Kathy Smith was also very volatile as a human being. Two of us could not be wrong. Heaven knows who keeps the golden rule. And I kind of get this feeling, the two of us can't be wrong, but we're the only ones who are right, that it's you and me against the world. Why he's mentioning the golden rule here, I'm not exactly clear on. So what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, the golden rule is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And he is not doing that here. He is perhaps cheating on his wife or someone else. And he's swept up in this romantic moment. And I think what he's acknowledging here, and again, you don't normally hear famous singer-songwriters talk about this, but a certain amount of selfishness. He and Kathy are swept up together, or whoever it is, and they're in love or physically attracted to each other, and basically they're not paying much attention to what other people think about what's happening at this point in their relationship.
So there's a little bit of a desensitization, and I'm using, you know, a very clinical term here, but they're really not caring about doing unto others. In this case, it would be their significant others. Or anybody else. I mean, they're so wrapped up in their own pleasure that they're kind of saying, well, screw the golden rule. We're not going to be paying any attention to it. So in that sense, that rings true for what you've been saying. I think this time we've learned enough to know that nothing is the same, but still the pounding of my heart hasn't changed and leaving so strange. So he still has a lot of feeling for her, whomever she is, even though the marriage is over. So if we're talking about Britta, then he still has some feelings for her. And that'll show up in Beautiful and other songs that he'll write from time to time. But they've learned, like every young person does, that those fairy tale endings that we have when we're in our first relationship, the very first time we're in love, those are fairy tale endings. I mean, that's exactly what they are. They are not what life as a young person is really all about. Not what happens in the real world. If we all ended up marrying the first person that we fell in love with, the divorce statistics are bad enough as it is. I can't even imagine what they'd be like under those circumstances because you're just too young.
I think, again, we're switching time, I think, from the time when he and his beloved end up in the house on the shore. Here, we're back to the present time, and he says, we've learned that nothing is the same. Still, the pounding of my heart hasn't changed. To me, that is such a beautiful line, which means we've been through a lot. Things are not the same. We've had our problems, but I still feel you in my heart in a way that is important. It strikes me he could be bitter if the relationship has really gone sour, but he's holding on to some sense that he still loves her and cherishes that memory. I think it's a very generous sentiment that he expresses at this point. I think it's very lovely. And he says, you know, let's focus on the good times. We've been through a lot, and the music is beautiful at this point in the song. I mean, the arrangements, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that a little bit. But it's a wonderful sentiment, I think. A song that could really turn quite bitter is saying, wait a minute, my heart hasn't changed. It's been a lovely time.
You said that there's bitterness, maybe even a little resentment, that I've gotten so involved with something. I have lost so much control over what I'm going to do because I'm letting my heart lead me. And there's probably a subconscious of, you know, you did this to me. I would not have lost control if you had not come onto the scene or if we hadn't fallen for each other or whatever. We will see the day when you or I will stay or face up to the end. So again, this to me is an admission that he knows that this isn't going to work out. He knows that this is ending or it has ended. And by the time he has performing this, I mean, the end has arrived. Okay, he and Britta are no longer together. Even legally, they're not together. But while he's writing it, he's saying, okay, are we going to fight or are we going to keep pretending? You know, are we going to hold on to something, whether it's fantastic or whether it's just the nitty gritty of working in relationships, or are we just going to, you know, let's face the music. This is over, you know, let's move on. And the fact that he's not able to get out of this, you said again, I mean, it is a sign of weakness. It's also a sign of humanity, because I don't know that there are too many men of that age and with that kind of psychological makeup that would have the strength to get up and leave.
Yes. And also what I love about this part of the song is he realizes he's sort of balanced on a knife's edge. I should be leaving. We are going to be leaving, but still I have these feelings. And he stays there for this song. He really explores this moment, this ambiguous moment, the way I think all really great artists do. It's a moment of transition. It's a moment where my life is changing, your life is changing, and here we are. And that's unusual, I think, in a pop song.
I don't know that it's unusual in a pop song, but I think it's unusual to have been explained this well and to admit that level of weakness or that level of incapacity to do something. Many times, I mean, you hear about things like Addicted to Love or I Can't Stop Loving You or, you know, things like that. But those are more, bubblegum is not the right word, but they're sugar highs, as opposed to the poetry that goes along with what we're talking about here. And there is some beautiful poetry. We all know that Gordon was second to none in the poetics of his music.
I think that's a really nice way of putting it. It's a very deep dive into this moment in their relationship, which is great.
And a dive that not many artists would have taken that we hear in music on the radio or that get published. We'll be right back to our conversation with John Kalaga about Now and Then, but first a word from a podcast partner or two.
Is that song really a cover? What instrument are they playing there? What do those crazy lyrics mean? If you're the kind of person who thinks about stuff like that, you're in luck because I've got just the podcast for you. How Good It Is chooses a single song each episode and takes a dive into the story behind the song and the artist who made it famous. I'm Claude Call. You can find me in your favorite podcast software or just point your browser to howgooditis.com. How good it is.
The American West is a place of lore and legend, of triumphs and tragedies. No one can tell the true stories of the West better than author Rick Steber. And now there's a podcast showcasing his work. It's called Writing the West, and every episode will feature his short stories and his poetry.
If you want to know the true stories of cowboys, pioneers, miners, and Native Americans, this 15-minute podcast is for you. Riding the West is available on Spotify, Audible, Podbean, or wherever you get your listening matter. That's Riding the West, the work of Rick Stieber.
Well, the song appeared on Cold on the Shoulder. That was his 10th original album. And to me, it's striking, John, that he made 10 albums in 11 years. I mean, that for the 1960s, 1970s, you're talking about 64 to 74, 75. I mean, that's unheard of. The Beatles did that, but the Beatles were being controlled by people saying, come on, guys, you get out there and do another record, money, money, money. And Lightfoot wasn't in that same category in a lot of ways, but recorded in 74 and then released in 75. It was produced by Lenny Waronker, who would go on to do more stuff with Gordon. As I said earlier, it's the 11th song out of 12 on the record. It's the fifth song on side B of Cold on the Shoulder. It was not released as a single, and I agree with that decision. This was not going to be a single that would sell. I think probably because it was just too deep a dive. Do you think that was the reasoning that they had?
I do. I mean, I think it has the classic Lightfoot sound to it, but I think the subject matter is a little too ephemeral and subtle to be a single. It's a great song, and as I said before, I think it's a song that you can grow old with. It's a song that bears many repeated listenings, and I think it's one of his best, but it's not really the stuff of pop radio.
The album did do pretty well. It went to 44 in Australia, number 3 in Canada, and number 10 in the U.S. So it showed that Lightfoot still had some residual glory from Sundown. And this, of course, this album stands on its own, but it's a smaller album in a lot of ways than Sundown was, or than Summer Chime Dream would be the next year. So the timing of this was actually very good. It continued a streak for Lightfoot that was going to continue for a couple more years. When I listened to the music of it, there were two things that really struck me, and then I wanted to hear what your impression was on the musical aspect of it. The bass was absolutely perfect, really drove the song for the emotional part of it. Obviously, there was rhythm to it. I don't know if it was John Stockfish or Rick Haynes who played on this song. They're both listed on the album credits. But I think as much as, if not more than, Jim Gordon's drumming, the bass really was the element that kept the song going and had a pop feel to it. And then the other thing that I noticed is that the opening riff is almost a note-for-note predecessor of the riff that Don Henley used in The Heart of the Matter. And I don't know if there was ever any notice of that, or if Lightfoot knew it and said, ah, never mind, or whether Henley went to Lightfoot and said, hey, can I use this? But I think it's more than coincidental. So I want to hear your thoughts on what I've just said, and then I also wanted to know what your favorite musical aspects of the song were.
Well, there are several. I love the bass playing, as you mentioned, and that particularly when he sings the lyric about the pounding of my heart hasn't changed, it's at that exact moment in the song where the bass takes on the beat of a heart. It actually thumps along beginning right there. It's a less of a rumba type beat before that, but once he says that, the song picks on an extra propulsion from this bass line, which changes a little bit. I love other parts of the song. I think Gordon's voice is great. It's warm. It's world weary. It's perfect for what he's singing here. If you think about the melody of the song, it's a beautiful melody. It modulates up and down. It goes in unexpected places. It's not your typical simple folk song. It really is a very interesting vocal arrangement. And I wanted to put in a plug here for just the general string arrangement here. I know Nick DeCaro did a lot of his strings. I think the strings in this are beautiful. They swell up at appropriate moments, crescendos and diminuendos throughout that are just perfectly done. subtle but beautiful and really add a lot. And look, come to find out that Nick Tejero is a kind of an interesting character. He died early, but he did arrangements for many, many people, including James Taylor and Ricky Lee Jones and many others. He was quite an amazing arranger, and I wish to know more about him, actually.
Well, you know, I may do at some point in this great odyssey that is the podcast, I may do an episode each on the Sidemen or on the other people who were directly involved. So I might do an episode on Nick. I might do an episode on Red. I might do an episode on Terry or Pee Wee or Rick or John or people like that. There's got to be some biographical stuff out there, and it would be fun to look at just the biographies of these guys. Speaking of the personnel, we know that Gordon was playing 6 and 12 string acoustic guitars and doing the vocals. I don't hear any piano in the song, but I know that he played piano on the record, and we know that he had some piano theory, so he knows how to play at least some piano. I don't remember him playing a whole lot of piano accompanying himself with songs, but in any case, Terry and Red were playing acoustic guitar. Red was playing classical guitar on the record. Pee Wee playing steel, and the steel is pretty prominent in this song also. We talked about Rick and John, and then Jim Gordon doing drums and percussion. And you mentioned Nick Tejero. So this is the usual lot that had gotten really tight with Gordon since Sundown, although I don't think he had a drummer on live performances at this particular time. When he does, it's going to be Barry Heffernan, not Jim Gordon. He played this song 202 times in concert. And the very first time was July 12th, 1975. He was supporting the record. And then the last time was just a few weeks before his last ever concert. He played it at the Algonquin Commons Theater in Ottawa, September 1st, 2022. And I think his last concert ever was about a month after that. I'm not exactly sure, but it was at the very, very end of his performing career. Let me ask you this. In the times that you saw him, did he ever play this song?
Not that I recall. I don't. And I was actually very surprised to hear that he had performed it so many times. I've never seen a live version of it on video or any other way. So I think that's great that he did. I had no idea.
I don't have a breakdown about when he started and stopped doing it, but of course he had such a panoply of great songs to choose from that I think the fact that he played it as many times as he did showed that he really loved this song and it meant a lot to him. I could only find one cover of the song, and there may be others that are unofficial. Barbara Jay, who has been a guest on this show before, covered this. And that was the only one, the only English cover that I could find. John, is there any that I have missed?
I'm not aware of any.
Kind of a shame because it is such a great song, but it also comes back to the next thing that I was going to ask you, which is, I don't know that there's anybody in modern music or people who are no longer around that could do justice to this song. I think this is one of those where very, very few people could really make this their own that I could think of. I guess what I'm wondering, John, is there anyone that you would like to hear record this song, either that's still around or if we could reincarnate somebody who you would want to hear do it?
I actually gave that fair amount of thought. And to me, the voice of the person who sings this has to have a certain amount of maturity, warmth, and experience all baked into the vocal. So two singers that I like a lot that I don't know, I mean, they're relatively well-known, but not superstars. A folk singer by the name of John Gorka, mm-hmm. and another by the name of Richard Schindel. Both are probably in their 50s now. They both have sort of bass baritone voices that are well-lived in. I think they would do a good job with it, and both of them are subtle singer-songwriters. The other person that comes to mind and is someone I'm sort of having a crush on right now is Rose Cousins. I don't know if you're familiar with Rose Cousins. She's a Canadian songwriter. I believe she lives in Halifax now. She's a two-time Juno Award winner, I've come to find out. And she does an absolutely stunning cover of If You Could Read My Mind, a song that I've always thought no one should touch, But if you get a chance and your listeners get a chance, you should check out Rose Cousins singing If You Could Read My Mind. She has a very soulful voice that is very flexible, and I think she could do a good job with it as well.
No, I haven't heard about Rose. I know Gorka's work. So I'm going to have to look into those. And you've just made me realize how much fun it would be to get everyone who's still around who covered one of his songs and to get them on the show. So thank you for that. You may have just extended the life of this podcast a little bit longer. This is one that I didn't send you, but one that I have been asking all of my guests, and you're going to be the last one that I ask because we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of this happening. Do you remember what you were doing and where you were when you found out that Gordon had passed away?
I don't know exactly, but I'm sure it was on social media that I learned about this and really turned to social media. There were a number of wonderful tributes to him that were published really almost immediately after his death. People who knew him and talked about him. Can't say that I was in my car and I had to pull over or anything like that, but I remember thinking in the weeks up to his death that he looked unwell and quite frail. So I wasn't completely surprised, but it hit me a lot harder than I thought it would. And it continues to. I continue to think about his career and, like probably everybody who listens to your show, gone back to the beginnings and kind of traced the whole process through. And it really was a remarkable career that he had. And it's a blessing that we've been able to enjoy his music.
Yeah, and that we were able to enjoy it for so long. I think probably the best way to sum up his passing, since this is the last time I'm going to bring it up to my guests, is that Gordon's death was not a tragedy. It was not a senseless thing where he died of an overdose or was murdered or something like that. So there was not a tragic element to it, but it was absolutely a sadness because it meant that somebody who we had been relying on to say the things that we couldn't say or to sing the things that we couldn't say or feel was not going to be there anymore. So tragic, no, but sad, certainly. And a sadness that will linger mixed with the happiness of knowing that the music goes on because it always has. John, as we're sort of wrapping up here, any other thoughts on Now and Then before we roll this Miley Wurlitzer into the night?
Not really. I just wanted to thank you for allowing me to talk to you today and to share my thoughts about it and to talk to you about it and to just remind everyone, if they haven't heard the song in a while, that it's a great song, that it really holds up. And I think it's a classic Lightfoot that really belongs on a very short list of his very best songs, which is really saying something.
John Kalaga, thank you so much for joining me. Great conversation. I hope to have you back on the show again very soon.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
And thanks for listening, everybody. If you like this well enough to listen to the whole thing, tell somebody about it. Carefree Highway Revisited is on Apple, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your listening matter. Our website is www.lightfootpodcast.com. I'd like to make a special request for you to visit my Patreon page. I love this show so much, and I want to keep it going, and you're in a position to help. Please head over to www.patreon.com/carefreehighwayrevisited. A dollar or two a month is all I ask. You can reach me, Mike Messner, at teachermike72@gmail.com. Well, our next episode will be joined by John Paul DeGay from Perth, Australia. He and I will be discussing Somewhere USA from the Sundown album, which came out in 1974, and that episode will be coming out in late May 2024. Until then, for John Kalaga, this is Mike Messner reminding you, run for the roses, but don't forget to stop and smell them. We'll see you next time.